Y'all are going to make it. Lindell's not here because he had a procedure done on his heart, and he's got a cough, and they're afraid that his scars or his stitches or whatever might burst, so they want him to be real quiet, you know, whatever. This procedure they do on his heart has to do with veins in his legs, and they're very important veins, and if they rupture, it's life-threatening, so they've got to make sure he's still. So he's doing well. His surgery went well. Everything's fine, except they don't want him moving, and they don't want him coughing, and so he couldn't teach this morning, so I took it for him. So your sigh of disappointment is well noticed, I understand. All right, thank you, Susan. I got one fan. There you go. All right. Revelation chapter 16. It was rather short notice, or I would have given it to somebody, you know. I'd have called up somebody and said, hey, take the Sunday school message. And but just, I didn't know about it until yesterday, till Friday night. And so I decided I'd go ahead and take it. And there's something it's been on my mind for a while. And I didn't really have time to put it all together, but I do more or less know what I'm wanting to deal with. Look at Revelation chapter 16. Look at verse 19. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of His wrath. I want to put you into the context here. Revelation chapter 16 is God preparing the very final days of the tribulation. It's called the last plagues. Those seven vials that those angels were holding off to, and you can do some guessing as to how late in the tribulation this starts happening. I'm thinking it's in the last month or two of the tribulation when these vials begin to start being thrown out onto the earth, and everything is happening in order to bring all the nations to a valley in the Middle East called Megiddo, and here it's called Armageddon, and they're moving all of these armies to this valley because God is going to prepare a spectacular end to the tribulation. And that's when He's going to come back. It's the Battle of Armageddon that happens in Revelation chapter 19. And this is when it all begins. This in Revelation chapter 16, all these nations are being forced by God, through all kinds of things, to be moved over into a certain valley where He is going to then have one significant battle that ends the tribulation and ushers in the armies from heaven, and Jesus Christ is going to come back and finish that battle off, pretend, save His people Israel, and the saints are going to be following Him on white horses and dressed in white, and you can read that in Revelation 19. It's a tremendous culmination of the Bible, and we know of this as a future. This is a prophecy. This is something that's going to happen. Some people think that Revelation has already happened, and so now it's in the past. But there are several reasons to believe that the book of Revelation is still future. And one is because where it's written, the guy who wrote it says this is future. This is going to happen, and so we know that John the Apostle wrote this toward the end of the first century, so we know it didn't happen in the destruction of Jerusalem and things like that, so we know it's still future. And another reason why we know it's still future is because the things it describes have not happened. Sorry, it's not there. You don't see these things have happened. And we take it as literally as we possibly can. If it's made clear that it's literal, you should take it literal. And if it's possible to take it literal, you probably ought to at least consider the possibility that this is literal. Things that are happening in here are things that are going to happen in the future, and it's going to be a time of tremendous tribulation. Jesus called it a time of affliction that has never been seen on earth before. And think about the types of affliction that have been seen on earth when they're pretty severe, and Jesus said they're nothing compared to what's coming. And so when you read the book of Revelation, you see all kinds of things happening. I mean, comets falling and the sun being darkened and the heat scorching and plagues of spiritual demon-like things coming around and all kinds of horrible things. And we could try to symbolize things, but you got to be careful with symbols. Because, you know, you could be wrong. And the truth is, it's not impossible for these to be literal beings. There are a lot of creatures that we don't know about. Even on this earth, folks, they estimate that we have not even seen, we have not yet visually seen or documented or described more than half of the species that exist right now. Physical, natural species that we still are discovering. They discover, you know, dozens every year, maybe hundreds every year. New species described, and they're not like anything else. So the idea that there are creatures out there that we don't know about is not a far stretch. That's not a difficult thing. Anyway, the book of Revelation, taken as literally as possible, believing it as it stands in its plain speech, trying to understand what's going to happen in the future, is not a real far stretch if you believe the Bible at all. Things, very unusual things have happened in the Bible. And so when God says He's going to spectacularly make an end of this earth history and usher in His kingdom, it doesn't surprise me at all that He would do it with a tremendous, fantastic display of poetic justice. And that's what he claims that He's doing here. But I'm not going to deal with the book of Revelation. It's been done to death as far as I'm concerned, and I have a hard time connecting all the dots. And if I can't connect all the dots, I just don't want to get into it. I was taught not to teach what I don't know, what I don't understand, and I have messed up by doing that sometimes, so I'm gonna learn from my superiors and not do that. But there is something here that is important. It's one of the more important doctrines historically of the church. One of the most important doctrines historically for the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. One of the most important doctrines concerning as far as the evangelical movement or the modern missionary movement or whatever you want to call it, what came out of the Great Awakenings. This is one of the hugest, most important doctrines that spawned the independence of the United States. And I know that might surprise you, but this country is founded upon an understanding of things that are happening here. And even in this verse, Revelation chapter 16 and verse 19, Great Babylon came into remembrance. Now think about it. Here we have God. He's already gone through about 7 years of serious plagues on this earth. And I mean, the earth is probably diminished in population by half, maybe even more, because it several times it says a third of all the people on the earth died, you know. And so you keep adding up and you figure out how many people are dying. A lot of people have died. And we're talking about huge wars and a one world government dictatorship when they won't even allow people to buy or sell unless they belong to this government. They are part of this group. And this one dictator or one king comes up and he is possessing the world, and God is fighting him with people that believe in Him, and the battles are coming together, and God Himself is saying, all right, I'm moving this here and I'm moving that there, and I'm set, okay, I've got these plagues here ready to go. And God is choreographing this entire spectacular end to history, and as He gets it all ready, the vials are poured out, everything is that, and all the armies are moving into the Valley of Megiddo, ready for the final deal. It says, Babylon came to mind. God says, I got something to do first. So maybe we need to know what Babylon is. Maybe Babylon has some significance. And if you knew how important this doctrine has been in history, beginning, of course, with the Apostle John and the Apostle Paul, and these apostles that understood something that they're trying to get across to us, but even more than that, the first few centuries of the Christian church, people depended upon the book of Revelation about Babylon and all that, to help them get through these tremendous persecutions that were happening because of the Roman Empire that was not Christian at all. And they were trying to destroy Christianity because Christianity was one of those doctrines or religions that they could not assimilate. And the Roman government, the Roman Empire, had assimilated almost all the religions. They had just swallowed them whole and taken over them. And the Roman idea was, we have taken them, we've gotten their gods, we have their spiritual power, that sort of thing. It was a very pantheistic, you know, accept all these gods. But they couldn't do that to neither Judaism nor Christianity. And so they were persecuting Christians pretty bad. The early Christians being martyred and trying to survive, they used this doctrine of Babylon, this understanding of what Babylon is, and they applied it to the Roman Empire. And they had their reasons, and I think you can see it very clearly. We'll show you what I mean by it when I get to the identity of Babylon. But they depended upon this book here of Revelation to help them get through the tribulation that was happening, because they could see in it, they could see their own circumstances in it, and there was that promise that it's going to be defeated. And you can read the books written back in those days. There's one by a guy named Lactantius. You can read his. It talks about the end of these emperors. And he actually writes in there the way these worst persecutor emperors, the way they died. And it's a fascinating little read. It's, you know, it was written in Latin, but they've got some translations of it into English. You can get them on Google Books or whatever. Lactantius, like around the year 300, something of that nature. He writes a history of how such and such an emperor died. And all of these emperors that caused these tribulations, these persecutions, they killed thousands of Christians and killed them in spectacular ways in order to make an example of them. Well, they all died in pretty bad deaths. You know how Herod, in Book of Acts, chapter 12, Herod died a very significant death? He's the one who killed James, the brother of John, with the sword, and he was persecuting the church, and then he started becoming really exalted, and God said, all right, that's the last straw, and he kills him. But he doesn't just kill him, he gives him a disease in his bowels, and he fell down as he was giving this speech. And it's not just the Bible that we have this history from, we have it from Josephus and other sources that this fella, he fell down and they had to carry him off, and then he was eaten from the inside by worms. Something was happening to him, his innards were falling out, and it took him a couple of weeks, but he died in agonizing pain. And of course, that's right. Sorry, I'm not trying to be too graphic, but there's the idea. This is the idea that God says, you're going to die a spectacular death because of what you did. And then God says why he did it, because he gave not God the glory. He exalted himself. And so here we have these emperors that during the first 200 or 300 years of the church's history, they were killing Christians, and yet this fellow Lactantius writes, these ones, they died in a spectacular way. And they were fueled in this trust in God, who was going to avenge his saints by this book of Revelation, and its promise to remember Babylon and what God was going to do to them. But not only in the first three centuries, this doctrine of Babylon became very important in the Middle Ages. And especially, now I gotta tell you, I have not found anything by Wycliffe or John Huss, the pre-Reformation people that dealt with Babylon. It's not that it didn't exist, I don't know, I just haven't read them. But I know that it was a big deal, because they were trying their best to say that Babylon has to do with pagan Rome, and it's over now, because now Rome is Christian. But when the Reformers came along, and I'm talking about people like Martin Luther and Calvin and these people who were in the midst of it, it came clear to them what Babylon was, and it became a very huge doctrine for them, how they were to apply this book of Revelation to their day. And they applied it what they call the historical method of interpretation, and they believed that church history was working itself out according to the book of Revelation. And so they found all kinds of symbolism in the book of Revelation and pointed, and you'll see why they began to abhor the mixture, the priestcraft, the mystery that was in the papal Rome or the Roman religion. It was a very polarizing thing, how you took this doctrine of Babylon. And then, of course, we have the days of after the Protestant Reformation. You had the English Reformation, where we have people who were reading the Bible very literally. These were the Puritans. They read the Bible very literally. They took Israel to mean Israel, not the church, and they began to understand the Bible as literally as possible, and then they began to see what was happening, and they began to apply these prophecies in a practical way, and they began to predict that God was going to reestablish the nation of Israel, and the temple was going to be rebuilt, and these things were going to happen, and they began to teach the Bible basically the way we understand it, and that's taking the book of Revelation as a prophecy of things that are going to be happening in the future. So, the doctrine itself has been an integral part of our understanding of Christian doctrine from the beginning. And I don't think that's a mistake. I think it's made clear here in the Bible that there's something going on. And that's what I'm wanting to deal with. I'm going to try to divide it up into three. I didn't have time to really lay out my outline first, but I know basically the outline I want to deal with. I want to deal with first the identity of Babylon. I'm going to try to touch on that today. And the identity is, I think, very, very provable. And then, of course, I want to deal with the significance of Babylon. Let me see. The significance to all of the different groups. And then I want to deal with the warning that comes in the Bible. And it's not just one warning. There are many warnings in the Bible about Babylon. That's our responsibility. If I can, I'll get through the whole thing today. But that's not usually my way of doing things. But anyway, all right, Babylon. Its identity. What is it? Who is it? What? Well, it's a city. It says so right there, Revelation 16, verse 19. And the great city was divided into three parts. Somebody says, well, what does that mean? The great city was divided into three parts. I don't know. And I honestly don't care. I don't know what that means. I don't know what it's in something in the future. I'm assuming somebody's going to know something when it comes time for them to know. If there is a great city, it was divided into three parts. I think that's a future thing. And the cities of the nations fell. And obviously, this Babylon is aligned with other cities. And great Babylon came in remembrance before God. So, we're talking about a city. And, of course, Babylon was a city. You guys remember Babylon. Of course, Babylon was a very ancient city. And, in fact, the word Babylon in our Bible comes from the word Babel, which you heard the Tower of Babel, right? And so, there is an association between Babel and Babylon. And some people say, well, Babylon is the city where the Tower of Babel was. And maybe it is. The Bible doesn't exactly say that, but maybe that's true because it's the same name. It's the same word. And so the idea is that it came from there. So we're talking about like an original city in the Valley of Shinar, you know. And this valley is between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, a very fertile valley over there. And this city, if that's the one, if that's the valley that it's talking about in Genesis chapter 11, where God goes down and says they're building this tower to reach into heaven, you know, and whether that's an observatory tower or whether they're making prayers on this tower or whatever, they're doing something to reach unto heaven, and God says, I've got to stop this, I'm not going to let this happen, and so He confuses their languages, and from then on, they have all kinds of internecine wars between them, and they all divide up, and then the Bible actually goes to the trouble of telling you this group went this way, and this group went that way, and this group there, and those are very important verses in the Bible so that you can identify different prophecies in the Bible. Like you want to know, you know, what is Javan, what is Greece, where does this come from, what is Dodo, you know, whatever. They've got all kinds of names, and these names are important. Don't think that just because a certain part of the Bible is a little boring that it has no meaning or that it's not necessary. You can't cut it out and have nothing lost. You'll lose something if you cut it out or if you just don't pay attention to it. It's all important and it needs to be read. And you do begin to cross-reference things if the more you read it, the more you understand it. And of course, many people have gone along before you and have done tremendous studies on all of these verses. But anyway, the idea of Babylon being that city where it all began. This is the original. And there's other reasons why. The religion of Babylon includes things that we have written in our Bible about that original city, like Nimrod, and that it was a great, you know, this great thing, and that what was happening, and the languages and all that. The actual origins of Babylonian religion includes all those types of things. In fact, I don't know if you realize it, but the original stories that you find, you can actually go back into Babylon, and you look up. They've got all kinds of clay tablets and stone things that they've unearthed, and they've translated, and they've got them out. You can see, you can read them from the Code of Hammurabi, which was, you know, 2,000 years before Christ, and they've got the epics that they have in there that follow the Bible stories very similar. In fact, nowadays, scholars will say that the Bible was not written until the Jews were taken captive to Babylon, because there's so many similarities between what's found in the Old Testament, like in the book of Genesis and things, so many similarities to what is found also in ancient Babylon. So they'll say the Jews got it from them and made up all this to create their Hebrew cult. Which is nonsense, folks. I'm just going to tell you the truth. It's nonsense. The Bible is a written history of the Jewish nation that goes all the way back in an independent witness to all of these events. And Babylon has their own version of these histories that happened, including the Epic of Gilgamesh, which, you know, this Gilgamesh went and found the original Noah, called Utnapishtim, whatever, in Babylon, in Chaldean history. And it's the same story. It's very, very similar, almost identical, so many parallels. And you find this same story in China. And you find it in the Incas. And you find it in the Aztecs. You find this same story about the flood and about the family that was saved and that came out on dry land and peopled the earth after that. It's the same story. You find it in India. You find it in Thailand. You find it in the deepest parts of Africa. The same story. So, this Babylon was that original city. Now, we say, well, we're taking it literally, all right? We got to take the Bible literally. Here it talks about Babylon, and so it has to be that city. It's got to be rebuilt. And I've actually heard good Christians speculating that in the future, the city of Babylon is going to be rebuilt, and is going to dominate the world again, and all these things are going to happen literally. And that's trying to be literal, and that's a noble effort, but there's a problem with that. Look at Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13. Look at verse 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there, but the wild beast of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, etc. The point here is that long before Babylon took over Israel in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, 100 years before, God prophesied that Babylon was going to be destroyed. And when it was destroyed, it says, it's going to be never inhabited again. It's going to be desolate forever. Nobody's ever going to go back and live in that spot anymore. So we say, wow. Well that, and by the way, Babylon is destroyed. It's a big mountain of ruins over there in Iraq, about 35 miles south of Baghdad. Just a big old pile. Just a mountain, really. Just a big old hill there, and it's just ruins. And so you think, well, how could Babylon, the city in the future, be rebuilt so to fulfill the prophecies that are going to happen about Babylon in the future literally? And I personally don't see how in the world you can take God making a prophecy that Babylon is going to be destroyed and it'll never be inhabited again. And so then it gets destroyed and that's not the fulfillment of the prophecy, so that it's going to get rebuilt again and then destroyed. And if that could happen, well, then you could never trust anything that he said. If he said that, he obviously meant for us to understand Babylon, the ancient city of Babylon, was going to be destroyed and never rebuilt again. When did it get destroyed? Look in Jeremiah. Look in Jeremiah chapter 50. Jeremiah, there were three sieges of Israel, of Jerusalem, by Nebuchadnezzar. Three sieges. The first siege happened in 606 B.C., and that's when Daniel was taken captive. So you'll read in Daniel where it says, when the city was taken by Nebuchadnezzar, I was one of the captives taken off. And he was one of the royal captives taken off in the first siege. About 8 years later, they revolted and Nebuchadnezzar came back and had a second siege. Or maybe it was 11 years later or whatever. Anyway, there was a third siege. And the second siege is when Ezekiel was taken captive. By the way, you can read Ezekiel, and if you'll put all the cross references together, you'll see exactly when it happened. Jeconiah was taken captive, and Ezekiel was taken captive. So Daniel was taken in the first siege, Ezekiel was taken in the second siege, and by the time Ezekiel was taken in the second siege, Daniel was already famous. He was so famous that Ezekiel mentions him as a very righteous Jew, you know, and so... So Ezekiel was taken in the second siege. And then we have Zedekiah revolts again, and that's when Jeremiah wrote. Jeremiah has to do with the third siege. So you have Daniel, the first siege, Ezekiel, the second siege, and Jeremiah, the third siege. By the time Jeremiah's there, God has prophesied Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. It's going to be wiped out. It's going to be left uninhabited. The walls are going to be knocked down. The temple is going to be destroyed. All of the treasures and riches are going to be taken off. And that Babylon is going to dominate for 70 years. Now that's the prophecy you find in the book of Jeremiah. Now look at Jeremiah chapter 50, because toward the end of the book, this is before it's all happened, they've made some prophecies, but now that Nebuchadnezzar has taken over the city, God gives Jeremiah a preview of what's coming. Look at Jeremiah chapter 50, look at verse 9. For lo, I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From thence she shall be taken. Their arrows shall be as a mighty expert man. None shall return in vain. And if you keep reading, you still read this chapter 50 and chapter 51 and chapter 52 of Jeremiah talking about what's coming for Babylon, that Babylon at that time. The armies from the north are going to come in and they're going to take over Babylon. This was prophesied not only that it was going to happen, but the day was prophesied. I mean, right down to at least a year. He says 70 years. So that you'll read over there in Daniel where he says, I was reading Jeremiah. And Jeremiah said 70 years. And so he said, God, 70 years. Here it says, 70 years. So he begins to pray. And sure enough, It happened. It happened in Daniel's lifetime, which is amazing. Daniel lived to be a very old man. All right. Look at chapter 50, verse 13. Because of the wrath of the Lord, it shall not be inhabited, but it shall be wholly desolate. Everyone that goeth by Babylon shall be astonished and hiss at all her plagues. Now, here's the prophecy. We already know in Isaiah that there was an ancient prophecy saying Babylon was going to be destroyed and never inhabited again. Then here is the prophecy. It says it's going to happen in 70 years. It's going to be kingdoms from the north, and that's the Medes and the Persians. They're going to come in. They're going to take over Babylon. And here it says, and it's going to be destroyed, wholly desolate, and never inhabited again. So not only do we know that it was prophesied, we know when it was going to happen and how it was going to be fulfilled. Look at verse 26 of the same chapter. Chapter 50, verse 26. I don't know why I changed the page. It's right there. It says, come against her from the utmost border, open her storehouses, cast her up as heaps, and destroy her utterly. Let nothing of her be left. Look at chapter 51, verse 26. That's why I changed the page. They shall not take of thee a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith the Lord. Look at verse 29, same chapter 51. And the land shall tremble in sorrow, for every purpose of the Lord shall be performed against Babylon to make the land of Babylon a desolation without an inhabitant. So, the prophecy is Babylon's going to be destroyed. It's going to begin this destruction 70 years after they destroy Jerusalem. It's going to be taken over by foreigners, and the Medes and the Persians are going to reign over all of these. And you'll remember Darius the Great reigned, and then Cyrus reigned. Cyrus was one of the ones that broke in through the law. And you can actually read about this story. They diverted the river of Euphrates while the people inside Babylon, because they were in such a fortified city that it could not be taken over, and it was pretty fortified, but they were having a party in the center of the city, and they diverted Euphrates and walked right through the tunnel, the channel of the river. The whole army went in there and took it over by complete surprise while they were having a party. And you can read about that party in Daniel. You can read about it. It tells you about it. It tells you about that guy named Belshazzar who was in charge of it and got the writing on the wall right before it happened. And it happened that very day. So it's all intermixed. Anyway, it says this city is going to be taken over. And then it's going to be systematically destroyed, dismantled. And they kept it going, and they had wars between it. And it was still a city until Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great actually died in Babylon. And when he died, all of his generals divided up the world from Babylon. And then they began to fight amongst each other. And by the year 275 B.C., Alexander the Great died in 323 B.C., so within 50 years, they had completely destroyed the city, and nobody lived there since then. 275 B.C., they say, it was nobody there, nobody has lived there since then. But we have a problem. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5. Look at verse 13. The church that is at Babylon, elected together with you, saluteth you, and so doth Marcus my son. Peter is in Babylon. Peter, during the New Testament, is in Babylon. I thought Babylon was going to be destroyed and never inhabited. See, people will assume that the Bible has errors because it contradicts itself, and they just have too little information, and they're making assumptions that they shouldn't make. Babylon was not just a city, it was also a province. It was a province in Persia. And the province in Persia called Babylon, the Babylonian province, was not the city that was destroyed. That city is still destroyed. It's still a mountain of heaps of ruins and junk. But the province of Babylon over there in Persia was a significant community of Jews since the time that they were taken captive. A whole lot of the Jews that were taken captive to Babylon never returned to Jerusalem, never returned to Israel. And a tremendous number of them. And the reason why, if you want to understand how it works, is that Babylon was a tremendous city, the largest city in the world back in those days. It was huge. And different cities have had this distinction to become the largest city, and everything works through this city. All of the commerce of the world, everything going on anywhere, all of the education centers happen in these big cities. It was Babylon for hundreds of years. Babylon was the big city. And so you have these Jews that were taken captive, and these Jews were of a people that had learned how to read. They were the people of the book. They were one of the few nations of people who knew how to read. Almost every Jew was taught how to read, so they could read the Bible. And they knew how to read, and so these Jews were considered very educated people. And so they were hired up and made use of. They became very useful all over the world. And so you had this huge community of Jews in the city of Babylon. Then when it was destroyed, These were still very useful. Remember Daniel. Even though the city, Babylon, was destroyed, Daniel stayed right on as the leader of the wise men in Babylon. Even Cyrus and them, they kept him right on because these were very, very literate, very educated, very wise people. And in this center of commerce, this Babylonian center of commerce, the Jews weren't going to just leave they had houses, they had buildings, they had educational centers, they had jobs. And so they stayed there. A whole lot of the ones that believed went back to Jerusalem. God called them, they went back to Jerusalem and rebuilt Jerusalem. And that's fine. But that was actually a minority of the Jews that went back and reestablished Israel. And it's happened that way throughout history, where the Jews would get taken off somewhere, and yet a whole bunch of them stay there. And that's why during the time of the New Testament, you find Jews everywhere. There are Jews in every city. And why? Because all the different times they were taken off captive, they were considered very valuable. These were highly educated, intelligent people that were considered very valuable to any commerce, whatever. And so they wound up being a significant community in all the major cities of the world. And so there was a significant community in the province of Babylon, even in the New Testament. And Peter found his way there and wrote his first epistle of Peter. He wrote it from Babylon because of this significant Jewish community there. And there was a church there, obviously. And so none of this is a contradiction. This is all a clear statement of what Babylon was at the time and had been destroyed as a city. And so at this time of the writing of the New Testament, Babylon did not exist as a city, but there was a province. In fact, I personally believe that it was from that community of Jews that the wise men came to see to receive the birth of Jesus, you know, a year or two later. I believe these were Jews in those days that came. You know, I know you see the pictures in the Christmas pageants, and one's a black guy and one's an Indian guy or an Asian guy or something like that. The Bible doesn't say that. It's obvious that these people were waiting for the Messiah, and they came to bring presents, and they were rich and what have you. And it wasn't just three of them, folks. I know in the Christmas pageants and in your little manger scenes and such, you got three wise men there. But the only reason why it ever came to be thought of as three wise men is because there were three gifts mentioned: gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So you have gold, incense, and myrrh, very, very valuable things at that time, and they brought them and gave them to the baby Jesus, or the two-year-old Jesus, however old he was at the moment. But the Bible says that when these wise men came from the east, the whole province was astonished wondered at this. And if just three solitary guys came in, on three camels, and I mean, remember, Jerusalem was obviously, every year they had over 1 million visitors from outside. This is a town of 50,000 people, had 1 million visitors every year. And three guys from the Orient comes in, it's not going to cause a stir. But when you have a huge caravan of wise men coming from the east, and these people come in and they're looking for the king of the Jews that has been born, whoa, this caused a stir. And Herod says, yeah, you guys let me go worship him too. When y'all are done, come back and let me know. That's what happened there. I believe that has to do with this community that was in the east, in Babylon, the Babylonian province. And these people were highly up to date on the status of the Messiah and all of these things. So we have Peter now. He's in the province of Babylon, and he's writing this letter. And so now we have John the Apostle. And John the Apostle writes this book of visions. The book of Revelation is basically a collection of 13 visions that John the Apostle saw. And these 13 visions have to do with wild things that are going to happen in the future. And one of these things that he mentions there is Babylon. Now you want to understand then, what is he talking about? He says it's a city. And we know that the original Babylon is no more. Not only do we know that it was destroyed and it's just a bunch of heaps, and not even the Arabian pitches his tent there, we know that it's never going to be rebuilt. It's never going to be a city again. So we, as Bible believers, we say, what is he saying here? What's going on? Well, go back to Revelation. Parts of four chapters Parts of 16, all of 17, all of 18, and parts of 19 deal with this city. So we're going to get to look at some key words. The first key word that you want to see is that it's a city. This is a city. It's not a province, and it's not an idea, and it's not a spiritual entity. This Babylon is talking about a city. It's a great city. Another thing is that it still exists in John the Apostle's day, because it talks about it in the present tense. It still exists. Look at verse. I can't read my own writing. I guess that's verse 7 or 9. Look at 17, verse 9. Verse 9. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Everybody in that day and today knows that the city of seven hills is Rome. There's no way John the Apostle would have written that in there about some other city. It's defined, folks, right there. The city he's talking about is Rome. It's Rome. Even Roman Catholics agree. It's Rome. Nobody can logically deny that it's talking about that city of Rome. There's a couple other key words that are going to make it clear. Look at verse 18 of chapter 17. 17:18. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. All right, it's the seat of an empire. It's the main city of an empire that reigns over all the kings of the earth. John is writing during the Roman Empire, folks. The Roman Empire held the whole earth. And so when he does all of these kind of like third-person identifications, he's not being subtle. He's telling you, I'm talking about this kingdom that is this empire that's reigning over all the earth, that's a city. It's called Rome. Rome is this city called Babylon, Mystery Babylon. Look at verse 15. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. All right? This is a multicultural, multi-nation empire with many languages. Even the original Babylon doesn't really fit some of these things. This is Rome. Look at chapter 18, verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins and that you receive not of her plagues. The people of God are in the middle of it. The people of God are in her midst. Now, what we have here is a clear reference to the city of Rome in the time of John the Apostle. The city of Rome has its dominance over all the world and reigns over many different languages and is a city, and it's the city that sits on seven hills. Seven mountains. There's almost no logical way to identify this Babylon with any other city than Rome. Look at chapter 17, verse 17. For God hath put in their hearts, talking about these 10 kings or 10 nations, God hath put in their hearts to fulfill His will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. This is talking about something that's going to happen, and that Rome is going to be a power player, a broker, perhaps a peace broker in the future, because these kingdoms that are warring and that really don't like her, they're going to agree, they're going to make a decision to give over the power to this Roman city for a while, for something to happen, and this is God's doing, because He's getting ready to judge her. Now, just to give you an idea of what the prophecy really is trying to say, from our standpoint, the prophecy is saying that Rome, this city over here that's called Rome, which is right now a city of no real significance, except that it's the seat of the Vatican, which is the Roman Catholic Church, but that's a little bit different subject. The city itself, Rome, it's just one more city out there. Not even a very interesting city as far as I'm concerned. I know some of you guys, if you would take a trip, you'd go to see Rome. I wouldn't. I would just skip right on by it. I'd go see something else. But Rome, some people really think Rome is something to see, you know. But I've seen pictures of the Colosseum, and I can't imagine anything else worth going to see. But Rome is nothing spectacular, nothing important. Right now, it's not the center of commerce of the world. No. Not even with the Roman Catholic head organization. It's just, it's not that important. There are many other cities today that are more important than Rome. New York is more important than Rome, economically and for the leadership of all in all sorts of ways. Frankly, London was way more important than Rome historically from our modern vantage point. And you've got Tokyo, and you've got dozens of other cities, not only that are bigger, but are more important. But Rome has one thing that's going to make it important, and it's going to be worldwide important. It's going to be the focal point of this contractual agreement between all of these nations that are warring, that have a problem. And that's talking about something that's going to happen in the future. What's going to happen in the future is something in Rome, Rome itself is going to be an important city because it's going to broker a peace that's going to have something to do with the last days. And there's other verses that line up with this, and I'm really not wanting to get into the prophetical side of it. I'm wanting to be into the doctrine of it. And oh my goodness, I'm out of time. Let me tell you this, the city of Babylon is not only identified by these key words, what it is and how we can identify it, it's also identified as the spirit of ancient Babylon. There's something about ancient Babylon mentioned in the Bible and defined in the Bible many times. Let me just give you an overview of them. It talks about the spirit of Babylon is fornication or a spiritual uncleanness, and that has to do with the assimilation of other religions. Has to do with idolatry, and we'll deal with that. It also, the spirit of Babylon has to do with motherhood. That's a whole lot more important than you might think at the moment. It not only does it spawn, but there's an obsession with motherhood among in the Babylonian system, including their trinity that has to do with the mother of God. Narcissism. It's a self-love, self-satisfaction. It's a pride. I sit a queen. I see no sorrow. I'm going to be wonderful. Everything's wonderful about me. It's a city of merchandise. It's a spirit of merchandise, a commercialization of this city. Sorceries, including priestcraft and all kinds of little mysterious rituals that are done. It's a spirit of persecution and world domination where they are actually willing to kill you and even torture you. It's a spirit of delicacy, gaudiness, art, and luxury. You'll see it, you read it in Revelation chapter 18, you'll see what I'm talking about. And it's the spirit of Antichrist. Antichrist not meaning against Christ. The word anti is a Greek prefix, which we nowadays use it in the sense of against. So if we say anti-abortion, we're against abortion. Or if we say anti, you know, communism, well, we're against communism. But back in the day, the word didn't mean necessarily against. What it meant was counterpart or instead of. So this is Antichrist means the counterpart of Christ. Something that's basically taking the place of Christ in the doctrine or in the world. All right, I don't have any more time, but that's what we're going to get into when I begin teaching my own time of Sunday school.
Thank you, Bill.
Hopefully.